of fluctuations which we observe today. So this to put things in perspective. So now I'll draw, we have three speakers today in this session, Stefan Alexander, Daniel Lipkin, and Mr. Strasky. And I will draw three arrows. We will sort of go in reverse chronological order. So Stefan is going to talk about things that we can actually measure in these fluctuations, in particular correlations between gravitational waves and other observations. Now you see one of the windows of ignorance, which I didn't emphasize yesterday, was this window of ignorance, the high density ratio of ignorance. And this is where the second talk will fit in. Question is, can we, using certain quantum gravity models, do we actually get an insight of what gives us inflation? And finally, this question of origin of these fluctuations. And this is where the third part will fit in. So these are the three arrows. Now I would like, again, since two of the talks are going to be related to fluctuations, I would like to write down a few equations, just to put down, put the discussion into perspective. Okay. And in fact, it's not me who should be doing this, talking about fluctuations, but it is really Jim Bardeen, who's sitting in the front row, who is the father of the theory of cosmological perturbations. He should be presenting this. So, when we deal with fluctuations, we have a classical background metric, and we have small amplitude fluctuations about that. So I'm using conformal time, beta, and the metric. I'll write it down in a particular coordinate system, in a particular gauge. And I'll be assuming that there's no anisotropic stress, in this case, focus on adiabatic perturbation. And this phi of T and X, coupled together with matter fluctuations, these are the cosmological perturbations. Now, these are not independent because they are coupled together by an Einstein constraint equation. So for adiabatic perturbations in models without anisotropic stress, there's only one scalar field degree of freedom. And it turns out that a convenient variable, this variable was introduced by Sasaki and Mukanov, it's called the Sasaki-Mukanov variable, it's this combination of metric and matter fluctuations. So, metric fluctuation, phi, matter fluctuation. So here I'm assuming that matter is a scalar field, just for simplicity. And this is the fluctuating part of the scalar field matter. And this is the scalar field. So if you take the Einstein action coupled to matter, and you expand to quadratic order in the fluctuations, you find that the action for V is a canonically normalized scalar field action. And so therefore, what you can do is you can do canonical quantization of the perturbations. Okay. And after doing that, you get the equation which Joao emphasized yesterday, which in momentum space, each free mode satisfies a harmonic oscillating equation. And this then is a particular combination of the background metric and background matter. So phi sub zero is a background matter scalar field. Time is always derivative with respect to conformal. So what you and just for comparison, if you introduce the mu k to be the rescaled amplitude of the gravitational waves, hk, that's gravitational waves, mu k is the rescaled amplitude, then this satisfies a very similar equation. Okay? And there's a subtle difference between A and Z. Whenever the equation of state changes, then you have to be very, very careful about that. If you do quantum field theory on curved space-time, you get this equation, not this equation. So if you do quantum field theory on curved space-time, and you think you're doing cosmological perturbations, then you are very misled. And you are liable to make mistakes of 10 to the 20, as was made in the early days of inflation, which was a mistake which Jim corrected in the early days of cosmological perturbation theory. So it's this equation which I want to focus on. And this tells us that if you start with a state, which is a product state of harmonic oscillator ground states, so we take a Hilbert space, which is product Hilbert space, over harmonic oscillator Hilbert spaces, you start with a homogeneous state, then what you find is on sub-Hubble scales, where this dominates over this, you find oscillations. And on super-Hubble scales, you find this dominates over this, and it's squeezing. Okay? Now the last thing I want to do is I want to draw a diagram of what I mean by squeezing. So if we take one of these oscillators, we look at Q and P, we look at the Wigner function, it starts out nice and symmetric, squeezing produces something that is elongated Q and P. And then next comes decoherence, which means you pick out one of these two vectors, which then at late times starts to oscillate like a classical configuration. So this is just some background material. It's the theory of cosmological perturbations and two of the talks are going to deal with perturbations. So let me hand over the microphone, although I don't have the microphone, to Stefan.
So Robert was my first, my PhD advisor, so I want to copy him and not use this, but I'm going to have to be rebellious. Okay, so I'm going to talk about, actually I have, thanks for writing this, Robert, because you actually wrote down some diagrams that I don't have to draw anymore. So I'm going to talk about quantum gravity, and I'll be very specific what I mean by quantum gravity in a while, since it means many things to many different people. There's a multiverse of quantum gravity ideas. So let's begin. I don't want to erase this, and I don't want to erase that either. I'll erase this.
There's a third one right there.
Oh, that's right. Can we subtract time for the time it takes to bring these boards home?
No.
Oh, damn it. All right. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is what is baryogenesis? Okay. Baryogenesis is an observation. It's been observed in two independent ways, both in the CMB. So when we make the statement that omega baryon is roughly 0.5 of the total density, 0.05, sorry, of the total density, we are saying we're making a statement about the number of baryons, the total number of baryons in our universe. And so way back in the CMB, we constrained this number by looking at the peaks in the CMB. Also, if we look at galaxies, if we look at the abundances of elements, of light elements, the relative abundances, that the decay rates in very precision nuclear reaction depend sensitively on a number called a Saha number, which depends precisely on something called the baryon asymmetry index, right? So the number, the difference between baryons and antibaryons divided by the number of photons in the galaxy. All right, and both numbers actually agree. The number, you can turn this into this basically by making note that rho is equal to the number of species times the mass of the baryons, and then you can turn that into this number here. But the basic point is that observations, both for CMB, for WMAP, the latest WMAP, and also for nucleosynthesis, okay, constrain this number to be plus or minus 6.5, plus or minus 0.4, 10 to the minus 10. These numbers differ by some decimal point. Okay, so the question is, not only do we observe more matter and antimatter as far back as we look, but the question for physics is, why that number? So it isn't to just say, I have more matter and antimatter, but can our physics, the physics that we know today, explain that number? Or can we predict that number? So that's point one. That's what baryogenesis is. It's a real observational fact that we're here. We need to confront it with experiment. So the question is, what's been tried before? If we look at our standard model as it is, for example, and we look at general relativity, so these are the theories that we have now been confirmed experimentally. What could, if we bring those theories together, can we explain this number? And the answer is no. So let me say why no, okay? So if we look at the standard model, it turns out that the vacuum state of the standard model is completely is anomaly free. So that means the quantum expectation value of the total of the complete standard model, where this is baryon, the baryon current, okay, and this is the VEV of the baryon current, d by dt of this is zero because of anomaly cancellation. So while individual triangle loops could violate baryon number, the sum total is zero. All right, so the standard model does not, right, the ground state does not produce matter over antimatter. That's the first statement. However, the electroweak theory at very high temperature or at temperatures above the electroweak scale, above TeV scale, has baryon and CP violating processes called sphalerons. These are basically time-dependent topological defects that could violate baryon number. And I will tell you why that doesn't work or why it's hard to make that work. So there is hope in the standard model. Now let's turn to supersymmetry. So the idea is that supersymmetry could actually, one of the reasons why people devise guts or supersymmetry, supersymmetric guts, is that this is another way maybe we have other operators in the theory that could be baryon number violating. Well, it turns out after, you know, over a decade of research in that field, the parameter space, for example, for the minimally supersymmetric standard model has mostly been excluded. So it's very hard to do that. Obviously, you can go to more exotic supersymmetric theories where you could futz around. We're gonna take a different approach to this, and that approach will be motivated by a question in cosmology. Okay, so first of all, let me say that why, if you were to try to do baryogenesis, what would you try to do? So I'll just use this one here. Anyways. Oh, thank you. So if you were to try to do baryogenesis, Sakharov taught us in the late 60s that you need three conditions. And of course, the first condition is that you need baryon number violation or lepton number violation. If you produce leptons, leptons will decay by the sphalerons and decay that will turn leptons into baryons by a fraction close to one. So you can produce leptons first and then baryons. That's called leptogenesis. The second thing you need is C and or CP violation, depending on whether or not it's lepton or baryon violation. So you need either one of those or both, depending on what you're talking about, the scheme. And these two things have to happen simultaneously. It is not enough that you're just violating baryon number, right? Because if you don't bias charge conjugation symmetry, you'll produce an equal amount of antibaryons, okay, and they'll annihilate. But even more constraining, while these things are happening simultaneously, Those processes have to happen out of equilibrium with the universe. Okay, so you need this to happen out of equilibrium. And this is where electroweak baryogenesis fails. It is very difficult to show that show that the electroweak phase transition is highly first order. You need it to be first order. And so far, that's been difficult to show. It's still an open question. So the question that we asked, this was some work done with Michael Peskin, Mohammed Sheikh Jabari, and myself, that we ask is, well, what does it mean? We know that the paradigm of cosmology is, at some point, as Robert pointed out from this picture, now I can bring this picture down, thank you for joining, save me some time. He's good at reading minds. That if we look at inflation, for example, we know that the scale of perturbations, and now I'm going to use this other thing. Here we go. Oh, what happened to your, here we go, perfect. Now these scale of perturbations, so let's look at the typical wavelength here that goes super horizon. As it comes back into the horizon, these are the things that source the perturbations, right? They couple to the fluctuation of the inflaton field, whatever the inflaton field is, whatever these quantum fluctuations are. This couples and produces density inhomogeneities, scalar density inhomogeneities that are to source structure in the universe. But you can ask yourself, you can have a thought experiment and say, since these are the structures that become us, become the galaxies, if I don't have a baryon asymmetry, I'll produce anti-galaxies as well. Okay? So it's not enough to just produce an inhomogeneity that will now become and grow into structure in galaxies and stars. But at some stage, whether it be during the process of reheating, okay, or before, I somehow have to bias the production of galaxies over anti-galaxies. So what if the phases that are established, the long-range phases that generate structure, that generate the scale invariant power spectrum, what if those things are actually responsible for biasing matter over antimatter asymmetry? And that was a question that we asked. So what I'm going to show you now is an instantiation of that idea. But instead of using the scalar perturbation, we realized that you need the tensor perturbation to make this work, which Robert wrote in here. I have 5 minutes? OK. So let me just tell you the basic idea. The basic idea is at the beginning of inflation, we have an inflaton field, whatever that is. So let's write this order parameter. And if this thing is a complex field, it has a phase times some modulus here. Now, ordinarily, this modulus is the thing that creates these fluctuations. But if this phase is non-zero and correlated on large scales, what we find is, and this is where quantum gravity comes in, that you can have theories of quantum gravity, and it turns out that both in loop quantum gravity, or the covariant form of loop quantum gravity, and in string theory, we have terms that are Chern-Simons terms. In the case of string theory, these show up with alpha prime corrections, and these are theta sectors in loop quantum gravity. But if we start off with a theory like this, it turns out that this phase actually, we can identify this phase with this field here. And how that happens is going to take another 20 minutes at least. So I'm just going to, if you buy this, then let's move along. If I linearize this action, and I now study gravitational waves produced here, what we find is the following thing. So let me, before I actually present the calculation, let me say very quickly, we're going to get lepton number now. Because if you look in page 199 of Steven Weinberg, there is an anomaly in the standard model due to gravity, gravitons. And it is 1 over 16 pi square r dual. Okay, so this does exist in the standard model. And it vanishes if I have equal amounts of left-hand and right-hand neutrinos. Okay? But if I have a very massive neutrino that's above those scales, this anomaly does exist. So if I have this and I have this together, it turns out that if the VeV of this thing during inflation is non-zero, I will produce a net lepton number. That's the basic idea. The question is, does this, what is this? And very quickly, let me tell you how you go about evaluating that. How you go about evaluating it is to realize that that this operator for homogeneous and isotropic space times is zero. But if I turn on tensor perturbations and I have more left-handed than right-handed perturbations, as what Zhao spoke about, and I plug it in here, I express it in terms of the tensor perturbation, it is non-vanishing. I have terms that look like this, or are dual. The first, there are three terms. One goes like d by dz squared, where z is the direction of propagation, hr, and d by dt squared, h left, minus the opposite, d by dt squared, hr, d by dz squared, hr. So if hr and h left are equivalent, this vanishes. But if I have different amplitudes of hr and h left, r dual is not vanishing. So the name of the game is to now go and calculate the gravitational perturbations during inflation for this linearized theory. And if you do that, something very nice happens. Of course, you know what the answer is already, I guess. But let me just show you how simple the equations are. How much time do I have? 1 minute left, OK. So the equation for h left looks like box of h left is proportional to, let me call this theta, plus h left, and box of h right is equal to minus h right. And notice what happens here. This is this is related to phi dot, okay? It's some dimensionless parameter that depends on phi dot, which is the role of the scalar field during inflation. It's related to the slow roll parameter. If this source was not here, then h left would be equal to h right. But because they're different, I'm going to end up with an exponential growth of h left and attenuation, exponential attenuation. When I plug this in, so the idea here, compute the Green's function for this, okay? And then I can express RR dual as an operator in terms of this Green's function. And that's exactly what we did. Once you do that, you end up with the following number, since I don't have. Oh, this one? When I do this, I end up with the following number. So the idea here is that d by dt eta of r of j0, which is the number density, is equal to the VeV of rr dual, which is a function of h left and h right. I don't have time to write the whole expression down, but you can look at our paper. And so I can immediately integrate this from 0 to h inverse, d by d eta r dual. If I integrate this number and I use typical values for the slow roll parameters of inflation, I end up with this number, 1 over 72 pi to the fourth, whatever. Look at this interesting thing, h over m Planck square. For the cosmologist, this looks very familiar, theta over h cubed times mu h over cube. We have a very interesting thing, which is that the number, the baryon, the lepton number is proportional to a contribution that is related to the gravitational wave power spectrum. The amount of CP violation, which is encoded in this theta, times, of course, the Hubble scale cube, or the Hubble volume, rather. So there's a volume factor. And of course, what you should expect is an enhancement due to the scale at which the lepton comes, the lepton mass comes in, which
mu is
the, mu is a lepton mass, yeah. So if I use 10 to the 14 for this, I use h over m Planck to be 10 to the minus 5. This is a free parameter in the theory. If this is a realistic number, which we cite in our paper, you do get 10 to the minus 10. That's an upshot. But the thing that is interesting, and I want to end my talk here, is that this nicely connects with some of the work that Zhao did, where what we're looking at here is really a bias between left and right-handed gravitons. So it will be interesting to connect this to the expectations that of the work that Zhao Li and Carlo did, where you guys looked at this TB cross-correlation, to see whether or not that cross-correlation could be related to N. In other words, can I constrain the Baryon number directly in the CMB through that observation? Okay, that's pretty much it.
Also have contribution from the market side, because the fluid has non-zero vorticity at the second order, and that will feed back into your...
Yeah, so I didn't have time to talk about that.
Estimate that it's difficult to...
It turns out the vorticity perturbation is zero, vanishes for the aura dual, and that was done by a Korean cosmologist. I forget his name, but that was calculated already. It's only for the tensor mode that this thing is non-vanishing. And actually, Adrian and Mark Hamminkowski and who else wrote a paper? Tristan wrote a paper also showing how you can constrain it using solar system tests.
Okay. Yes. Is there other observable where this theta enters? Like, is there other phenomena you can link it to?
Well, Nico is going to talk in general about, you know, if this field was still around with us today, what kind of constraints in the solar system you can make using gravitational wave physics, as an example, right? So stay tuned for Nico. He'll...
Wouldn't the whole calculation of tensor fluctuations be different if you had that kind of RRD defined? Different story as well, right?
Yes, yeah. It will be different, but you mean for the super... Oh, yeah, one thing I didn't say. You mean the...
It is different to the Fox's problem. Presumably, this is after green. Is this during green?
This is not... This is during inflation. Yeah. But the open-ended question is actually what happens during reheating, and that it becomes a mess, but it's doable in principle. That would actually... By the way, for this to work, you need spontaneous reheating or something very fast. But reheating could wash this effect away, so that's actually what Lattice is resting on. So some smart grad student need to do that. Daniel?
You mentioned that choosing a realistic value for this data, how you choose that value? What defines that?
Well, in string theory, this is nothing more than the volume factor. If I have this is four-dimensional, if I have a Calabi-Yau, there's literally a volume factor that depends on the string scale. And that number could be up to 10 to the 2. But in loop quantum gravity, it's literally a theta sector. And one of the things that I've been waiting for is to figure out how to implement this using spin foam methods. Ellie?
Yeah, about the relationship to the work we did with Zhao and Carlo Campaldi, and the work later that Zhao did with students, there are two mechanisms in loop quantum gravity by which one can imagine that there would be parity violation that enhanced the one felicity over the other felicity. Mm-hmm. One of them is this Chern-Simon kind of coupling, the phi RR tool that you studied and Nico is going to talk about. The other, which Zhao talked about yesterday, is to leading order in Newton's constant. This is to higher.
This is suppressed. Yeah, this is suppressed.
Yeah. And to leading order requires that the emergency parameter be imaginary, or at least have a large complex part. I think it would be interesting to read. It's not just a single plug-in and check. One would have to redo the guts of your calculation because the momentum dependence is different, and there's also no relationship to the anomaly.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so,
but it could be that the VEV that leads to the anomaly might still be non-vanishing, because all you really need is an imbalance of H left and H right.
But it's more than this. The thing I was pointing out, the equation would be different. The actual tensor
equation would be different, but what I'm saying is that this operator here is a separate thing from the theory of quantum gravity. And once you have that,
right.
You'll get a neck
Lepton
number.
So the RR dual is coming in twice.
Yeah.
In your mechanism. But you actually only need to come in once. That's your
point. Yeah, that's the point.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
This is a standard result in the standard model. This is standard. That's my point. This is model dependent. I mean, whatever generates a non-vanishing left-right will could in principle lead to a lepton number. We just applied it to that case.
Right.
Thanks for that point.
Is there no other questions? Let's thank Stefan again. Let's see if the miraculous screen mechanism works. So could the screen lower, please? Let's see if the screen listens. No, it's
you just speak in the mic.
Can we lower the screen, please?
We went for a couple.
Once you grab that thing,
yes,
it's threatened suddenly.
I don't know. Okay.
Detect the space. Detect the space.
Did you choose here? Did you choose here? Computer. Third. Input.
Wow, here we go. Okay. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to present some work at your meeting. I was talking about quantum gravity and hopefully some potential signatures thereof in cosmology. So I will start with quantum gravity. Now, these numbers here are...
Put the microphone on, please.
Yes, I can do that.
Nobody's lightning, too.
Yes. Is that better now? Okay. Good. So the numbers on this transparency are supposedly known to everybody here. So the interesting one has been highlighted by many of you already, which is this length scale of ignorance, which is of key interest of this meeting. Namely, the question as to whether measurable, experimentally accessible quantities can be linked to the physics originating from quantum gravitational fluctuations at expectedly length scales of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So this will be the recurrent theme, obviously, in this whole conference and also in this talk. Now, I will take a quantum field theory perspective on this type of question. And now, when you grow up with quantum field theory, the first thing you learn in school, so to speak, is that quantum fluctuations result into energy or scale dependence of couplings. And the best known example for that is certainly QCD, where we have measured the energy dependence experimentally, the strong nuclear force, and where we also have predicted this very same energy dependence by quantum field theoretic computations. So what I'd like to do is I would like to explore whether similar effect in gravity may have measurable consequences. So the first step you would want to do in gravity is you would want to replace Newton's coupling by a potentially energy-dependent or scale-dependent coupling G of mu, where mu now is your RG scale. Okay. Now, the asymptotic safety scenario, of which in a massive violation of causality, you will hear the actual introduction in the closing talk by Martin Reuter, is a scenario which even goes one step further. It's a scenario where you stipulate that Newton's coupling in its high energy limit, when the RG or energy scale is very large, actually softens in a characteristic way to make gravity weak at high energies. And it is the expectation that this type of weakening of gravitational interactions actually may be sufficient to turn gravity in a fundamentally well-defined quantum field theory, similar to those forces we know from the standard model of particle physics. Now, based on the quantum number of craziness which has been introduced in this conference yesterday, I would suggest that the craziness in this first assumption is close to zero, because this is something we indeed know from standard quantum field theory. You may suggest that the craziness in assuming or stipulating asymptotic safety is perhaps a bit higher, say one, because we, till today, have little experience in how to deal with interacting theories at short distances. And this would be a theory which at short distance would be interacting. So there is an element of craziness in it. I would call it one. The question is it enough craziness to for this to be actually viable as a physical theory? Okay, now let me skip these two technical paper slides, and as an appetizer give you one set of results where actual quantum field theory computations have been performed in a four-dimensional theory of gravity involving, as a fundamental action, powers of the Ricci scala up to the power 34, where we managed to confirm that indeed this theory is precisely displaying a non-trivial ultraviolet fixed point of the form postulated by Steven Weinberg. It's a stable result. You can go to a substantial high order in the space of fundamental actions, and the result is remarkably stable. So we can take that from now on as a working hypothesis to see what type of implications this behavior will have, possibly also for cosmology. Now, given that we have these results now out of real computations, good, I think this may even lower now the craziness parameter associated to the setup. Good. Now comes application where I will show you two diagrams, or three, which link the short distance behavior of a metric quantum gravity theory, which possibly its long distance behavior based on explicit RG computations. So what we would do is we take some action, say Einstein-Hilbert in this example. We could couple it to matter. There will be some gauge fixing. I mean, it's a straightforward quantum field theory type computation. Now, you've seen a phase diagram yesterday already, which Alfio showed you. It looked roughly like this one. I mean, number of phase diagrams of this sort have by now been computed. So in the phase diagram, you see the dimensionless Newton coupling G. You see the dimensionless cosmological coupling lambda. You see an ultraviolet fixed point. You see a Gaussian fixed point. There's something interesting going on here, which also corresponds to fixed point. And there's another fixed point down here at lambda equal minus infinity, corresponding to macroscopic gravity with a negative cosmological constant. So a bit more schematically, you can see it in this plot. And the important point I'd like to highlight in, with all of these phase diagrams is that we do have renormalization group trajectories, which technically link the short distance or ultraviolet fixed point, which we do need in this theory of quantum gravity in order to microscopically define the model, with a regime corresponding to classical, essentially classical gravity in the low energy regime, so the vicinity of this Gaussian fixed point B, and ultimately terminating in the vicinity of some infrared fixed point, which we have called C over here. Now, the details of what is going on at that infrared fixed point are a bit more subtle. So if you would zoom into it and shake the system a little bit, you would see that actually this point C effectively corresponds to degenerate fixed points, so several of which sit on top of each other. If you lift this degeneracy, that one fixed point would be a proper non-trivial infrared fixed point corresponding to strong gravity, postulated some time back by two of you here in the audience. And the other one would correspond simply to a conventional de Sitter type fixed point. Second computation has left us with a similar result. So here we use different techniques. This is why the plot looks a bit different, but the physics statement is the same. We have a UV fixed point, which is connected with a well-defined infrared fixed point down here. Good. So now let me use the remaining 5 minutes to talk about how this result from quantum field theory may help us to learn something about cosmology or possibly make some constraints about it. So let me recall a model of a way in which classical scalar field cosmology has been parametrized, something which I think has been invented by these gentlemen. So we want to put ourselves into a situation where we think of scalar field cosmology, say one scalar field, Friedmann, Robertson, Walker metric with flat spatial components. I mean, good, we have a Hubble parameter H, we have Newton's coupling, well, kappa, okay? We have some interaction potential for the scalar field. Now, the trick is to use these interesting new variables X, Y, Z, which allows you to write down some cosmological evolution equation for this system. These are all classical equations, which, however, takes the expansion of the system and the dynamics of the scalar field into account. So you end up with a certain system of equations, and here is the logarithm of this length scale A, actually minus the logarithm, but that's good, okay, technical point. Good. So this would be the dynamical system, and in this classical picture of cosmology, you wouldn't end up with a regime of inflation, provided that the running of H with cosmological time, or the E-folding parameter N, yes, is smaller than 1. What you then could do is you could analyze the set of possible cosmological fixed points in this setup. So there would be one. So the fixed points of the setup would be those where the time dependence of our dynamical variables vanishes. And I've given you the definitions here for simplicity. Good. So it is known that, I mean, the possible classical fixed points of this system, I mean, they have been classified. So you may have fixed points which are dominated by the potential. There are others which are dominated by the kinetic term. There are mixed fixed points. There's even a scaling fixed point which is responsible for quintessence type behavior. And there may be fixed points related to the fluid component, but that component is not interesting to us. So, question now, how can we take RG or quantum corrections into this picture? So remember where we started, we were taking classical Friedmann-Robertson-Walker equations, so classical GR equations, but we have G Newton in them, and we have dynamical equations for the effective scalar field. Thank you. So we have dynamical equations for those as well. What we'd like to do now is we would allow them to become running parameters which depend on the RG momentum scale. We would want to take the RG equations from our quantum field theory computations, which we've done independently beforehand, okay, and splice that one into the dynamical equations for the cosmology here. That's the plan. Now, what you have to do at one point in your computation is you have to link the RG momentum scale parameter with the parameters of your cosmological time evolution. And that's the main assumption we are entering here. We assume that the RG scale parameter will become a function of cosmological time. So the view behind this is that at early times, we would be probing very short distance behavior of the universe. So we would expect that the early time behavior is sensitive to the regime where Newton's coupling essentially is probed at very high energies. So we would expect that that's the regime indeed which would correspond to an RG momentum scale parameter, which technically would then be large, the UV regime of that theory. There's a consistency condition which goes with it, which tells us how the RG momentum scale evolves with cosmological time. And this is given by certain parameters, which all of which are related to the renormalization group equations of Newton's coupling and of the scalar field potential V and V prime. Now, if you do that, you will end up with a new set of cosmological evolution equations. They look like this. The first bit is the same, but then you will have additional terms over here originating from the intrinsic running, RG running of your coupling constant. So there are two new effects happening here. The first one is that the couplings themselves, because kappa and the potential and so on, they will be quantities which depend on the RG scale. That's the first RG scale dependence entering. And the second one is an explicit one due to these additional terms. So the dynamical equations are clearly different. And you can then again ask the question, what will be the cosmological fixed points of this setup? So you ask for the zeros of this equation. And what you find is the following type of things. So the first one is that you may find fixed points where, so let me start with this one. You may find fixed points where actually the RG scale stops depending on the cosmological time. This is a type of freeze-in behavior in the following sense. It means that you may have a cosmological fixed point where the underlying RG equations nevertheless have not reached an RG fixed point. So you can have a cosmological fixed point without having an RG fixed point. I'm speeding up. Thank you very much. Okay, so that's kind of funny. Okay, the second one is more conventional, namely, you can have a second set of cosmological fixed points where the RG scale scales in exactly the same way as cosmological time. That would mean, right? Because this will be a constant, some number, but not a function of anything else. Good. So if you play this game, you can then classify again the possible cosmological fixed points of that system. And you will see that the structure is a bit richer now. You still will find potential, kinetic, mixed, and scaling type fixed points. Okay? But now the conditions of existence will depend on information coming in from the renormalization group running of coupling. So whether gravity gets weaker or stronger at short distances or early times, say. Okay. And the question, obviously the question which the chairman asked me beforehand, will you speak about inflation? And I said indirectly. So here it comes why indirectly. The condition for whether these fixed points are inflating is related to whether dH over dN at that fixed point remains smaller than one or not. Okay, and so these conditions since we have an equation for how H looks like as a function of our variables, we can read that off from those fixed point values, and we will then see that that's again, a condition related to the RG equations of the underlying quantum field theory. But there are examples where these fixed points are indeed inflating. So that would correspond to a regime in this diagram where we really would probe the very early time behavior, but where we allow the underlying gravity sector to behave in a different way to what we would expect from the standard classical equations due to the underlying fixed point in the quantum field theory description. Good. I just put on the summary slide because elsewise the chairman quite rightly will nail me to the blackboard, and I leave it open for you to quiz me now. Thank you.
Yes, two questions. One of them is a question I find myself asking in every asymptotic safety talk, which is you're ignoring the Bossler term and the instability in the ghost, which we know is present there at that fixed point.
I have been ignoring the Weyl term in this particular computation I've shown you. The Weyl term has been studied by a number of authors by now, and it has been shown that the Weyl term is not causing trouble. You remember our discussion 2 years or 3 years back?
Yes.
Yes? Okay, when both the results of Max Niedermayer and also the results of Frank Sauer Essig and his collaborators have been presented, where they were showing the two type of fixed points actually do exist in the presence of a Weyl invariant. The first one is a fixed point similar to the QCD fixed point, where the Weyl coupling becomes perturbative. Okay, and
that's free.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Okay, and that and you may appreciate that result simply because in QCD field strength is conformally invariant, and actually it's Weyl is the partner structure in gravity, so it's perhaps not a complete surprise that that coupling could be asymptotically free. At the same time, it was also found, yes, that that system can have an interacting fixed point where the Weyl coupling is not free. So these are two candidate fixed points which appear once the Weyl coupling is included in the setup. But the instability you've been referring to in the quantum field theory computation, this instability is not achieved. It could have been achieved, but it so turns out that that instability, one is not running into it. Okay. So in those computations by now also have been extended, including meta fields and so on, to see whether the picture is more or less stable. And I mean, people have been seeing
so,
that
so
it is.
So there's a computation of an energy which is bounded from below, it's in the Einstein theory? I mean, if the instability is removed, then the energy, then there should be a positive energy theorem as in general relativity.
People have not been looking in this from the positive energy perspective. People have been looking into it from the explicit quantum field theory computation, which takes this potentially dangerous fourth order propagator into account, and asking the question as to whether a potential pole is achieved or not. And it is found that once the system settles on a fixed point, the dangerous pole is not achieved. Yes, I mean, it's quite interesting in two other aspects as well. I mean, you may well know the famous computation by Kelly Stelle, right, who was showing that fourth order gravity indeed is perturbatively renormalizable, but precisely having in perturbation theory this pole. Whereas later on, Weinberg and Gomez in 1996-97 have been showing that if you take infinitely many higher derivative operators into account, perturbatively, yes, the theory is not developing a pole.
Might not develop.
Yes, so that's the statement of their paper.
Right.
Okay, so these perturbative results, together with the result I just described, right? I think harmonize quite well in the sense that there is the higher derivative terms, in a sense, are not entirely evil, and it is reflected by the fact that the fixed points we find, okay, are such that the propagators effectively don't run into that pole.
I have a question. There's something that confuses me. Normally, the running of the coupling constant, these coupling constants run as a function of the momentum exchange in a scattering process. But here, right, they depend on the four moment on Q squared. So this thing is a Lorentz invariant. Here, on the other hand, it seems that your k is, in some sense, the scale of the wave function as seen in the rest frame of the cosmological, let's say, the preferred frame of the cosmological expansion. How do you do these two things match?
Yes. So the RG scale k I've been referring to, in a sense, spiritually speaking, kind of Wilsonian RG scale. So if you would want to have a view, kind of, I mean, the view which many people have is that you try to effectively coarse grain your quantum field theory over patches of space-time with increasing extension. And then try to develop a theory for the coarse-grained degrees of freedom, coarse-grained over some inverse length scale 1 over k. Okay. So the RG running, technically speaking, the RG running we are referring to has this construction principle underneath it. Now, for many applications, and in particular, if you look into, say, applications in QCD, yes, one-loop perturbation theory, for example, I mean, the leading one-loop running is identically the same, of course. So this is where universality would help us. But then if you say, okay, I want to study an explicit scattering process, I will talk about scattering in a different context on Thursday. Yes, you can do that as well from within this formalism. So they are very similar, they are very closely related and can be one-to-one translated. That's what I'm saying with this.
I think there was some. You had your hand up first.
I just wanted to answer to Lee's question that brought him with it in Sergio. That is
the discussion.
The main point to be observed is what Alfred was talking about yesterday, the conformal factor instability basically leads to the condensation of certain nodes that cause the ground state to be highly non-homogeneous. This is what we call the Lassalle vacuum, like the spaghetti vacuum in QCD. And so the error, the mistake people always make talking about this R square codes is they think in terms of the background, which is in this old studies by Stanley and others, is always taken to be Minkowski space. Minkowski space is far from on-shell linear to the ultraviolet 6 points. The cosmological constant is close to infinite, and Minkowski space plays a really no role. And so what really plays a role is something much more complicated as a self-consistent background, close maybe to the spaghetti vacuum. And what we had shown long ago with Oliver Lauscher and Christoph Wetter, that in a kind of toy model, is that this leads to a stabilization of the field that condenses. In that case, it should lead to a stabilization of the conformal factor at a sort of semi-classical level, and not a fluctuation, but a so-called stability-driven renormalization.
At this point, there's obviously a deeper discussion about the asymptotic safety scenario going on, which is not directly relevant to this talk. So I suggest that we postpone it for later. Let me ask if there are any questions which are specifically related to the talk.
So I have just a very brief one. So when you identify the normalization group escape, do you identify it with the Hubble constant or?
No.
What do you identify with?
No, we don't identify it explicitly. We identify it implicitly. We only assume that the RG scale should not. The assumption is the RG scale is a function of cosmic time in this. Yeah. Okay, we don't associate it to be proportional to h, although it may come out to be, actually in some example, it comes out to be proportional to h in a certain regime, but it will not always be proportional to h. It will be a complicated function of all the other variables. And the condition which we impose to fix that is Bianchi identity, so ultimately energy conservation.
So,
John,
you have a question?
So, I got a question about another aspect of infrared. So you mentioned cosmological constant. Has anyone talked about Mondrian behavior?
Yes, the gentleman sitting just behind you has played around with that idea.
The generous fixed point. Did I understand right? You say one of them corresponds to stronger gravity.
Yes.
How strong?
Well, if you got very close to it, it can become arbitrarily strong because it's a fixed point.
It could be divergent.
It scales in exactly the same way as the RG coupling scales. Okay, so G of energy scale would scale with some IR fixed point value divided by mu squared, and now mu squared becomes small. Okay, so that would, oh yes, I mean, it has been studied by Alfio and Martin some time back, where they hypothesized the existence of such a fixed point, and they looked into what that might give supernova from comparing with supernova data and trying to understand. Effectively, yes.
Yes.
we at that time were able to fit as good as the standard model using a Bayesian approach, because we had one parameter less. So in the space of theories, it was even better than the standard one. We have two parameters. We had to put that in the appendix because the referee was not happy with that.
Okay, so let's start to speak again.
Oh, thank you.
Why doesn't the talk appear?
Concerns the origin of inhomogeneity.
It's a different language.
Well, let's
add it to full screen. I don't know.
Full screen.
Yeah, it's in the Spanish.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
But the, oh. Okay, strange because now it's not here. Okay, thank you. I thank the organizers for a wonderful meeting. And the subject I'm going to talk about is a hard subject to talk. I was discussing in the elevator with Laurent, and he was saying one should be able to say everything one needs to say in 15 minutes. For me, it's going to be very hard because I first need to convince you that there is an issue, an open issue, in the standard account of inflation. And second, I will have to convince you that I'm allowed to take an orthodox position. In some sense, I'm going to take an almost heretic position. And as my colleague Phil Pearl says, question the dogma given to us in Mount Copenhagen many, many years ago. the work I'm going to talk about is in collaboration with all this bunch of people. And the way it connects with the issues at hand in this conference is we are looking for quantum gravity-related phenomena, and of course the place where one would like to look for that are the places where we find things we don't fully understand. And of course the most complicated aspect of the physics we don't really understand is the measurement problem in quantum mechanics. in fact, as Bell said, one can rapidly conclude that either the wave function as given by Schrodinger's equation is not everything or is not right. Roger Penrose and Lajos Diossi have been arguing for a long time that the resolution of this thing may be tied to aspects of quantum gravity, perhaps something along the ideas that they have proposed, that gravity in some sense forbids superpositions of things that differ, that give mass distributions that are superpositions that differ by too much according to a certain measure of this difference. Of course, one would like to have experiments for to test this, and there are ideas to do the experiments. But in general, these experiments are very difficult, are very complicated, in particular if one needs to take into account the measuring apparatuses or the observers that are generically in front of the experiment. And we would need, in that case, to have a realistic description, or at least a reasonable description of these apparatuses and observers in terms of quantum mechanics, if one wants to test these ideas fully. On the other hand, there is a situation where the measurement problems appears in a very, very clean way, in a very clean setting, which is the cosmological origin of cosmic structure that we were just introduced a moment ago. Okay, let me just remind you the data. This is the picture that the satellite takes of the CMB sky. And from this picture, which is basically brings us information about the value of the Newtonian potential that was presented to us by Robert in the previous well, in one of the blackboards that is behind the screen. So we get information of what is the value of this Newtonian potential on the intersection of our past light cone with the last scattering hypersurface, and this is the picture we get. This picture can then be codified in terms of some parameters called the alpha LMs, and these alpha LMs are nothing but the integral over the two sphere of that of that picture multiplied by the spherical harmonics, basically because one knows that the spherical harmonics comprise a complete set of functions to parameterize any function of a two-sphere. And then one goes to this quantity that is the quantity that is often presented to us in the analysis of the data, which is the average over orientations of this of the magnitudes of the alpha LM. And when one does that, there is an excellent fit between data and observations. This is the big success, or the great, one of the great successes of inflation. Let me point to you that perhaps, and this has been noted by other people, that perhaps there is the fit here is too good in the low L regime compared to the cosmic variance that one expects in that regime. Okay, so now let's consider that story. The story is the universe was filled at that time by one field that was in a state that is the Banach Davis vacuum. This state is exactly homogeneous and isotropic. And from this state, the inhomogeneities that lead to the appearance of galaxies, stars, and things like us appear. How does that happen if the dynamics of this closed system, where nobody is coming from the outside of the universe to make any measurement, does not break those symmetries? That's the issue which confronted us and that we wanted to investigate. People generically use decoherence to argue about this issue, but even the proponents of decoherence agree that there is a problem with decoherence. And this is a quote by Surek. He says, the interpretation based on decoherence and ion selection has not really been spelled out in any detail. I have made some attempts in this direction, but frankly, I was hoping to postpone it because it's filled with attributes, with notions of anthropic awareness, perception, observership, which cannot be modeled in any desirable degree of rigor nowadays. But moreover, I would say in the cosmological context, all these things don't help us because we want to understand the situation before there was any observer, any measurement, any awareness of any or any of those things. So this story clearly cannot be of much help there. Okay, so our approach is going to differ, and I'm going to deviate a little bit from the presentation that Robert gave. And the reason that I'm going to deviate is because I will try to implement some ideas that are difficult to implement in the context that Robert presented. Our approach is going to be based on the following observation, which is that the situation we face here is unique. It's the unique situation, this quantum emergence of structure, is the unique situation in which three things combine: quantum, plus gravity, plus observations. There is no other situation that is available to us where these three things come together. So what we are going to do is given this, it wouldn't be so strange that something appears there for the first time that has not become manifest elsewhere. We want to have a space-time description of the stories, because I want to talk about emergence of the system of structure, and emergence means something that was not there at the time appears at a later time. That's the essence of the question. And the type of ideas that we are going to try to implement are these ideas that involve collapse of the wave functions. We are going to consider modifications of quantum mechanics by some means. We are certainly not the first people to do this type of things. These ideas have a long history, going to Girardi, Rimini, Weber, Perl, Diossi, Penrose, Bassi, and some people coming in late trying to make the theory covariant, at least especially relativistic covariant. And even Weinberg last year wrote a paper talking about the need for something of that sort. So what's a collapse theory? A collapse theory is something in which you modify the standard evolution of quantum mechanics, adding to the theory some new terms that involve two things. Involve some operators towards which the state is driven inexorably. In the case where this theory was initially developed, the preferred operator was selected to be the position operator, just because people believe that in some sense always you always measure something, you always observe systems in states of well-defined position, but this is not important. The theory can be generic. And there are two aspects to the theory. One is that there is a random function that appears driving the, modifying the, how am I doing this? Oh God. Okay. Anyway, so these are very interesting theories. They pretend to unify the collapse, the two types of evolution that we have in quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, we have the unitary evolution driven by the Schrodinger equation and the collapse of the wave function when we measure. These things try to put them the two things together. Okay, I will not follow any particular of those theories because there are several, but we are going to assume that something like this happens in the early universe, taking the vacuum state, the Banch-Davis state, into some other state. The assumption would be that at time eta k, the state, the mode k of the wave function collapses to a new state that is different from the vacuum. The idea is to use semi-classical gravity, so in that sense we're going to deviate from the structure that we were presented, in the sense that we will not quantize gravity. We will take the view that gravity is in some sense Einstein's gravity is to be viewed as a type of hydrodynamical description of some underlying theory that perhaps is loop quantum gravity, causal sets, or something of that sort. But anyway, that you shouldn't take Einstein's equations as a fundamental, but as something of like a Navier-Stokes type of equations. And in that sense, you should quantize the quantum field and not this combination that we were presented before. When you do that, when you quantize the quantum field, this perturbation that we were introduced to, rescaling it appropriately, well, you know, you get this expression in terms of creation annihilation operators. Here you have the mode for the wave, for the field operator, where this factor appears that appears there is in some sense connected with this squeezing that we were told about. And the point the basic point is the following, that if you write Einstein's equations in the semi-classical level, you can compute the Newtonian potential given the state of the quantum field. And if the state of the quantum field is the vacuum state, this quantity here vanishes and the result is zero. However, if before that there was a collapse of the wave function, so the state of the field jumped to some new state in which the mode k acquires some expectation value, this is not the vacuum anymore, it's some other state, then your your Newtonian potential is going to acquire a particular value. And given those values and the times of collapse, you can reconstruct the Newtonian potential. Once you can reconstruct the Newtonian potential, you can reconstruct these parameters alpha lm, and you have an explicit expression of these quantities alpha lm, where you have this function that has information about when the collapse occur, what type of collapse occur, and some random numbers that appear in the collapse, like any collapse theory should have. When you do that, okay, you have an expression for this alpha LM, which cannot be written in any other approach to the problem. This is the quantity that we measure. And I would say that if I had these values of the random numbers that were chosen by the collapse, I will be able to give you an exact expression for this quantity. Of course, I don't have them. And then I have to do some statistical analysis, which basically says, This quantity is the sum of many numbers, and you're going to do these numbers have randomness into them. And when you compute something like that, you need to take into account that you have basically a random walk. And for a random walk, you cannot predict the total displacement, but you can predict the most likely value of the displacement. And that is this quantity, which nevertheless has this function that still has information about the collapse and what kind of a collapse occurred. And now there is a dependence of these functions on the time of collapse. And it turns out that if the time of collapse follows exactly the rule, time of collapse inversely proportional to k, you recover the standard results. But now you can test how strong are the data, how strongly the data predict or agree with that statement. And you can see that you can look at the different spectra that are obtained by choosing different values of the parameter. You can now sweep the parameter space and determine by Monte Carlo simulations what are the regions of parameter space that are allowed. So this is, in some sense, putting a constraint already using data about how stringent is this rule that the collapse time has to follow a particular scheme. So we are using, in a sense, cosmological data to learn or infer something about what this collapse theory may be. Since I have run out of time, let me not tell you about I cannot tell you more about it, but there are we have been involved in this for several years, and there are various directions in which this research has progressed, and we hope to keep progressing in the future. Thank you.
Any sense that you can think of some of these class models as hidden variable theories, or there's no relation?
Well, one of the versions of hidden variable theory is the Bohr theory, right? in which you which would realize a version of this thing. And people are doing studies of along those directions. In that setting, all the anisotropy would be codified in the initial conditions, because when you have a Bohr-like theory, a guide wave type of approach to quantum mechanics, you need two data. You need the wave function and also the initial position of your particles. Here would be the initial values of your field variables, and then the anisotropy would be there in that initial conditions. That's why I don't like it so much, because you have to, choose from the beginning very carefully these anisotropies. But in a sense, that would resolve the problem in a similar way. And in that sense, this theory, these particular random numbers that are appearing are sort of a hidden variable theory, but these are hidden variable theories that have no deterministic dynamics. So,
did you get whether you're thinking of this collapse model as phenomenological to talk about cosmology, or as really fundamental that you would apply to any quantum system?
Yep, I think it should be fundamental, should be applied to any quantum system. And the theory that I presented, the CSL theory, was developed initially for the collapse of the wave function of a particle. So,
what is the operator A in the direction that...
You would need to have a theory. I don't say that this is the theory. I would say a theory like this would have to work. I don't know what would be generically the operator A. I imagine that the operator A would have to do with something with the energy momentum tensor, because you want, in some sense, following the ideas of Penrose, you want things to go to states in which the metric tends to be well-defined, and the uncertainties in the metric are very small. So for that, you need energy momentum tensors that have small uncertainties, small variants. and if your theory drives the state of your quantum fields into fields that have relatively well-defined energy momentum tensor, the space-time is going to have a well-defined metric. But I don't have the theory.
So you mean you're thinking this A is biased toward locality.
Yeah.
Somehow, in order to have any collapse model, you need to pick a direction in phase space.
That's for sure.
And then, so.
That's for sure. But the interesting thing here is, if I didn't show, I didn't have time to explain, but I show you two types of collapse. There were two types, if you were able to read it. I collapse in two different ways here, and the two different types of collapse produce two different models of collapse that produce two different values of these functions and two different bounds on the data. So what I'm saying is the data can tell you which type of collapse is preferred. For instance, I can tell you that if you decide that all modes collapse at the same time, you get a spectra that is ruled out by experiments. So this theory, which is very simplistic, at a certain time everything collapses, that theory that is ruled out by experiment. So I don't have the theory.
So right? This stage is more like a
At this point it's like a toy theory. It's, my view of this situation is the following. When Planck was writing, trying to fit the black body radiation, he said, okay, what happens if things come in these packages? Energy, you know, radiation comes in these little packages. Didn't have any theory. He just saw that this thing fit the data. Once you have this fit, then you say, okay, what is the underlying theory that would explain all this? And for that, you need to say, well, what is the underlying theory that fits photons and also electrons and also many other things? But the first thing is to feed the data.
Ah. So after thanking the speaker again, let's all go down to the other.